Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Welcome once again to Whiskey Congress. Steve and I are together again in the Cleveland studio. We're drinking an impaled ale from Middle Ages Brewing in, where is it? From Syracuse, New York. Anyway, from a beer from our buddy Dave in Philly.
The Cuse.
I think it's good. It's pretty good. It's very smooth. So for an IPA, it's definitely not an over-the-top IPA.
It is good. I like it.
I mean, it's got a lot of flavor without, you know, it's not that punch in the face with hops that you hate.
It's weird. With me and the hops, there's some things that are very hoppy that I like. Other things, it feels like it leaves a film on like my tongue.
People say it feels like you ate a pine cone.
Yeah, that's not this at all. Actually, this has very little hops. There's no bitterness. I like it. And I appreciate it. Dave always criticizes me on my beer choices, you know, because I'm a Miller Lite Heineken guy. You know, we've talked about this all the time. Yep. Why that is, but this is a solid choice.
So we did that. We also have a whiskey to talk about. Brought here by you. Go ahead.
So this is the whiskey that we're drinking. It's a Macallan. It's a 12-year. It's a double cask, and double cask means that it's been aged in. They age it in one barrel for a certain amount of time, and then they age it in another barrel for a certain amount of time. And so the barrels that they use for this are sherry and then European oak, which is a little bit different than American oak. And so, you know, a lot of the whiskey that we drink is very smoky in flavor. You know,
right.
Your Ardbegs and your Lafleurs, and they've got that peatiness. This doesn't have that at all. This is just your... The scotch that more people are maybe a little bit more familiar with. And Macallan, they're one of the best at it. They have a kind of tried and true method of the way that they distill their whiskey. And so what they did here is they used sherry, they used oak, there was no bourbon cask used, which is becoming more and more popular in the realm of scotch. To bring that kind of American flavor and just kind of mix it up a little bit. And, you know, for this being 12, which is relatively young.
I didn't know that. I'm surprised.
For scotch, right. It has a very mature taste for a 12-year-old. And maybe that's because of the combination of the sherry, the stronger.
The wood,
I think they spent more time in the sherry cask than they did the actual English oak. But it's so smooth off the tongue. There aren't a lot of discernible flavor palettes. I think there may be some more refined ones, and maybe my palate isn't quite picking them up. But for me, I'm going to give this a 91 just for its overall. Oh, you gave it a 92.
Yeah.
Just its overall smoothness.
That's what won it for me is it's really smooth.
Right.
I mean, really smooth.
You know,
it's got a good flavor. You're right. It's not a complex flavor, but it just... You know, sometimes simple is good.
Right. I mean,
and I think this is fantastic. This is something I could drink. You can
sip it all night. And I mean, it comes through at about an 86 proof, or 43% ABV. So it's a little stronger than your normal, your typical spirit. But it's not so strong that after a couple sips, you stand up and you get punched in the face.
Right.
Where some of the stuff that I tend to like is 93, 105. 115, Blanton's can get up there with theirs and Booker's and things like that. So this is a solid offering from Macallan. I debated between this and the 15-year, and I went with this just because the double cask intrigued me. I hadn't had it before, and so there you go.
All right. Well, thank you. It's good choice.
It's going
all right.
It's going home with me, by the way.
Since when you stayed here and I wasn't here and you didn't drink my Blantons, I certainly can't blame you. You should trust me. I trusted you. All right, never mind.
It's not about trust.
No,
I just want it at my disposal.
Fair enough. You did buy it. So there were a couple celebrity suicides this week. Kate Spade died. I frankly didn't know anything about Kate Spade. I know she was David Spade's sister-in-law, which yeah. I didn't know until...
Let me jump in here. I like fashion, but not to the point where I dress ridiculous. But I pay attention to it. I think it's important, especially, you know, when you travel to some of these larger cities, whether it's Chicago or New York or Los Angeles or what have you. I think it's important to be aware of fashion so that you're not completely, you know, thrown off when you see something different than what you would normally see coming from the Midwest, you know, coming from a Cleveland, or when you see someone here that has stepped their game up, so to speak. You can process it a little bit better, and I think that's important. So I'm somewhat familiar with Kate Spade. She was a women's fashion designer. She, you know, purses, clothes, things like that. She was her design really brought a style aspect that may have been missing from, you know, professional women's style clothing that wasn't there before. And then she, from all accounts, had a great personality. She was a very attractive woman, always had a smile. She was very philanthropic, and she was just, she had a great kind of aura around her that, you know, makes this all the more kind of surprising. They said that she hung herself. She right. left a suicide note, and she hung herself. Which just really, you know, it really kind of caught me off. And obviously, as one who does not dress in women's clothes or wear a purse, have a purse or to carry a purse or whatever, the connection wasn't strong, but it still caught me by surprise. And then you follow that up with Anthony Bourdain
right.
today, this morning. Like, that was the first thing I saw, and I was like, you have got to be kidding me.
I was shocked. I saw your thing on Facebook. I was shocked how big of a fan of his and how much you credited him with influencing your food interest.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, no reservations. Man, I don't remember when that started. I feel like it might have been in college, but maybe I was in law school. But either way, when I started watching it, it just really opened my eyes, right? Because I'm watching this guy, he's got tattoos, he's a little rough around the edges, but he just had a way of speaking with, you know, as I said, you know, when I wrote it, is that he had an intellect that was kind of built around his experiences, but he felt like a person that you could talk to and you can engage with. He was a smartass, he was opinionated, and he had a strong personality. He was very flawed, but he was open about being flawed. And everywhere he went, he just wanted to connect with people, no matter who they were, whether they were black, white, brown, communist, whatever. Right. He didn't care. He went anywhere and everywhere. And everywhere he went, he had a friend. You know, everywhere he went, we're going to connect with my friend who's going to take us through such and such and blah, blah, blah. And he would go into people's houses who lived in huts, and he would eat their food. And that just opened my eyes to some of the different opportunities that were out there as they related to the human experience. And I just, I credit him with that, because I watched that show, and it literally made me think. I was the type of guy, I was like, I got no need or want to go to Europe. Why the fuck would I want to go there, right? Like, America's the greatest country in the world. Kicking ass and taking names here, screw that, screw those other places, you know? And then all of a sudden, I watched this man travel all over the world, all over this country, and just his experience with it, and I connected because of food, which a lot of us do, but obviously with me being a bigger guy, I like food. And he made me realize that there was more to food than burgers, ribs, pasta, pizza. Really began to appreciate food in a different light, and how you can use it to connect to people. And I did. Like, one of the things when I was in law school that I did when I would talk to girls, that was how I would kind of initiate a conversation. It was always, I always used food, right? To talk, like, you know, I would say, you know, hey, you know, we'd be waiting in line, you know, at the bar, and it's just like, all right, this is taking longer than I thought. I am hungry. Hey, what did you eat today? Did you eat anything good? You know, and a couple times it was like, no, weirdo, leave me alone. I don't eat. But right. Then, you know, I mean, then there were other times where it really started an engaging conversation that led to an engaging turn of events. So, yay. But
whatever, you know, whatever, I mean, whatever do you mean?
Right. I don't know. But I mean, that's the power of food. And he really kind of highlighted that for me, and I appreciated it for him. So it was that was a hard one to take this morning. And I wasn't sure initially what happened. So I was reluctant to say, well, is it really a suicide? Because they said they found him unresponsive, which doesn't tell you a lot.
Right.
But then I found out later that he also hung himself. And that is hard to work around.
You know, I used to hate Anthony Bourdain because he came to Buffalo and he was a complete dick. He actually went to a bar that a friend of mine owns. Now, my friend didn't own it at the time. But he was just, you know, in Buffalo, we have just kind of like an attitude back and forth with like New York City and New Jersey. You know, they consider us a cow town. We consider them.
You got the whatever. Little brother complex.
Yeah, exactly. And let me read a quote from Anthony Bourdain. A friend of mine from Buffalo posted this today. Buffalo is a different culture. I look at Buffalo and Buffalonians as a different culture now. 10 years ago, I would have looked at them as those poor guys who live upstate. And I'm lucky enough to live in Manhattan. That's the way I would have seen it 10 years ago. Now I see it as a very distinct personality, a very distinct culture with its own architecture, its own kind of feel. It's actually a weirdly wonderful place, even in winter. I think it took me traveling around the world to get to that point. Gosh, I just butchered that, and I apologize. But that really flipped me.
You know, his ability to recognize when he was wrong or just his ability to mature. And, you know, we've kind of been on this voyage with him, and we're talking about a guy who was 60 years old.
Right.
But he was still growing and maturing, and he had no problem letting you know that. I think that was a certain level of vulnerability that you don't see with a lot of people.
And one thing in that position. Yes, one thing I admire in people, and I try to do myself, I mean, this podcast is an example of it. I try to never stop engaging in new things. I started doing stand-up comedy at 43 years of age. Anthony Bourdain went on Joe Rogan's podcast, and I heard his story there, and that made me like him a lot, actually, when I heard that as a younger guy, he you know, had some issues and you know, battled back and got sober. And after a couple of days hanging out with Joe Rogan, he took up jujitsu at age like 56.
Yeah.
And I remember Joe Rogan talking about it, like, you know, this guy's dropped, you know, 15 pounds, and he's, you know, obviously taking that up at a later age, but he's, you know, he was impressed with how engaging he was, and he found a new thing to get passionate about and jumped right in. And that is what, I don't know, I didn't know anything about Kate Spade. Anthony Bourdain's shows and his interactions made you feel like you knew him.
Yeah.
And so this was a shocker for me today because, I mean, he struck me as like a lust for life kind of guy, and you never know what's going on.
You don't.
And I
you know, it's been around social media all day, but I mean, if you know someone that is in, you know, that's in a tough spot or that you're just not sure about, then, you know, reach out to them whatever way that you can. Extend a helping hand, give them a hug, pat on the back, make them laugh. I mean, do what you can for your friends, because hopefully, maybe, you know, that extra show of compassion or empathy or whatever, maybe that's the thing that keeps them here an right. extra day and maybe saves them.
I mean, there's going to be a benefit for mental health and suicide awareness in Lakewood. I'll tweet or somehow get the dates out, but it's in honor of a kid named Nick Ramsey, who was a stand-up comic that I knew, who took his own life earlier this year. And that really hit close to home. I mean, I knew Nick. We were friends on Facebook. We'd done same open mics a few times, but I wasn't really close with him. But a lot of my friends were, like, you know, hanging out with him on a weekly basis kind of friends. And, you know, it really shook up the Cleveland comedy community, and we're still feeling it. So, yeah, you just don't know where people's heads are, and if you're right, if you know someone or if you are in a spot where you think you need it, take a deep breath, reach out to someone you love, you know, there things will get better.
And if you're listening to this and you're in a dark spot, just keep listening to our show.
Yeah, we're uplifting.
Go back and listen to our old episodes. That will you will realize that, you know what, I could be these two assholes.
Yeah, at least I'm not them. It could be worse. So there's some Supreme Court news this week, and we've been waiting to hear a long time about this. Well, there's a couple cases in front of the Supreme Court related to quote unquote gay rights and right to deny services. And this was a Colorado-based case where a baker was declined to make a cake for a gay wedding, and the Supreme Court found in his favor. Now, this would normally be like an earth-shattering story that would occupy the news cycle for 4 or 5 days. But in this world, it's... Steve, until I started going through my notes for what we're going to talk about this week, I had forgotten that happened this week.
Yep. It happened this week, by the way.
Yeah.
Not last week.
Right, yeah.
It feels like it was a month ago, but no, that was literally 4 days ago.
Yeah. And so can you break down the case?
Yeah, so... what happened? You had a baker in Colorado who refused to make a cake for two gay men that were getting married. That's kind of the crux of the situation. Now, you're saying, how could this end up in the Supreme Court? The two men sued, saying that their civil rights are being violated. And civil right, you have federal and state. And so what happened in Colorado... in their, we'll call it their version of the Constitution, right? Just
right.
To keep it simple.
Right. Sure.
State
statutes or...
No. What I'm trying to say is in Colorado, gay, your sexual orientation is a protected class.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to say. Ugh, spit it out, Stephen. But sexual orientation is a protected class. In the federal government, it's not a protected class, right? But in the states, some states, and I forget the exact number of states, but there's a certain number of states that have said sexual orientation, gay, lesbian, straight,
right,
everything in between, is a protected class. Colorado is one of them. And so they took it on a state level and said, hey, our rights were violated. The state agreed with them and said, you're right. And so the baker said, well, I disagree. So he appealed, and it went all the way up, and it got to the Supreme Court. Now, some people are looking at the Supreme Court decision and saying that this is a blow for civil rights, this is a blow for, you know, gay people in America, and essentially people who own businesses are going to take it and use it as a way to discriminate against gay people, and who knows who else, possibly, you know, black people or Muslims or immigrant, what you may have. And looking at the court's decision, and people, now, there is one little caveat to this, little side note, is that, you know, when this was first reported, you know, people kept saying, you know, the headlines were it was narrowly decided.
I saw that too.
It was narrowly decided.
It was a 7-2 decision.
Well, okay, so you and Donald Trump Jr. are in the same boat.
Okay.
Because what they mean by narrowly decided is that their verdict is narrowly tailored to a specific aspect of this case. Not that it was narrow by... you know, okay. a 4-5
Well, that
decision.
Got to me because I mean,
it right. So
I thought you'd love to be with Donald Trump.
Well,
Jr.
Well, Donald Trump Jr. tweeted out narrowly. Doesn't look narrow to me. It was 7-2, right? Like, so he puts it out there, and pretty much every all legal right. mind.
I'm in the same boat.
Every
as
legal mind in America. Like, I saw it, and I think I actually retweeted it. Like, hey, you fucking moron! But now I realize, like, I'm being kind of a legal elitist in that. What they when they say narrow, they mean that the verdict or their decision was narrowly tailored to a specific aspect of the case, right? And the specific aspect of the case was going all the way back to the initial legal proceedings where the Colorado has a board that deals with these issues, right? With civil rights. And that board, what the court is saying is, listen, we don't necessarily disagree that this baker violated their civil rights, but in that particular board, agency, bench, when they made their decision, they were hostile towards the Baker's religious beliefs, meaning that when they were making that decision, some of the things that were put on record from the state, I just knocked the mic like a foot away from my face. But some of the things that were said by the state were obviously slanted against the Baker's religion or against religion in general. And from a federal constitutional Supreme Court perspective, that state agency, that government agency has to be neutral when it comes to religion, right? So their findings had to have been based strictly in law, right? And not biased against the person because they had religion. Just like they couldn't be biased against the gay couple, and we don't know what their religion is, but let's say they were atheist, the state agency that made that decision couldn't have been biased against them because they were atheists. And I'm not saying that they were, but if they were, they couldn't say, well, you don't have a religion.
I can't wait for Twitter to blow you up. You called them atheists. In fact, they were
right. But the state can't say they're godless. They're atheists. They don't have, you know, they can't like they can't use that as a reason to decide against them or for them. And they can't use the fact that the Baker has religious beliefs again against him or for him. You know, so it was the way in which they handed down their decision. Now, what that means is it goes all the way back to that state agency, right? So what they have to do is form their new opinion, like, without bias against religion. You know, so they can come back with the same decision, and once they come back with the same decision, minus the bias against religion, then it's unfortunate for the two men, or it's unfortunate for the Baker because it'll go against him, but then it will be legal. Now, the other side of this is everything that the court said from, you know, like the there were from, you know, all the concurring opinions are telling you that, listen, if this comes to us and the form and the process is right, then we're going to decide in the favor of protecting the rights of gay people. This didn't come to us with the proper form, so that has to be protected. But if it comes back to the Supreme Court, everything that they're telling us is that they're not, a lot of people are thinking that, well, the next one that comes, then that's it for civil rights, for, you know, like we're going to be back to segregation and Jim Crow. No, it's the opposite. Right, it's just I everything that you read, everything that was said by Justice Kennedy and every other Kennedy, Stephen, all of them, not Stevens. I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank. But but everything that was said tells us that the court is going to come out on what I believe the right side of this in protecting the civil rights of gay people, of, you know, obviously minorities and everybody else. It's just that the process of this was wrong, so they have to fix that.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you explained that. Now, you did sort of by default call me a moron in doing so.
Sorry.
but good, because I saw the same thing. I saw it narrowly decides, and I'm like, oh, 5-4, what a shocker. And I said 7-2, and that's what I thought. So
a lot of people are looking at the numbers as well and saying 7-2. Oh my God, trust me.
I don't remember the last one. I mean, the ones we see are the controversial ones. Yes, so
I mean, there's
probably
there's
a lot of 9-0s and 8-1s.
I mean, I think
there's
roughly 27 or 28 other cases on the docket, and of those, I think there's only two of actual interest to, you know, mainstream.
The Missouri one is, I think, the big one, right? I think the Missouri one was the one that was like literally discriminating against him. You're gay, let's talk about that if and when it comes to the court.
If they don't kick it back, we'll talk about it then. But so that's that case. And so, you know, if we have anyone gay that's listening, or transgender, if you know someone that's worried about this, I know it doesn't seem or feel good at the moment, but I really think that from a legal perspective, this is really going to turn out the right way long term once it, you know, if and when it gets back. But I'm sure it will. And it's just the process has only been extended. The court did not address any of the other issues in this decision. Let's just make that clear. They didn't address the actual issues that were at hand. They literally only addressed the process.
Okay.
And so and based off of what was written, I firmly believe that they'll do the right thing here.
You being a lawyer and me having gone through jury duty, when you see the process and how painfully meticulous it is.
That's literally like saying you being a bodybuilder and me having gone through gym class.
No, I'm just saying I've been up close and personal with, and your phone's buzzed like four times on the show, and you always bitch at me when I do that. So hot.
Sorry. And mine's right on my mic stand.
And way to go. Mike Wood called me an amateur when I did that when he and I were talking.
Amateur.
He did call me an amateur, and he might have a point. All right, so let's move forward to this week in Trump, because we do have to kind of keep it a bit short this week. First of all, last week we essentially criticized the fact that Kim Kardashian was in the White House to plead her case for prison reform in specific regard to a woman named Alice Marie Johnson, who was found guilty of basically a first offense drug crime where she did not really participate, but she was deemed to be.
She was a part of it. I mean,
I think her house was used.
She was like making appointments essentially for things like
that. She got a life sentence for that, which Trump commuted.
Yeah.
And I think that was the right thing to do.
First of all, when we talked about it last week, I was just like.
We were dismissive, right? We were
like. Nah, it was just like, listen, I didn't believe that she was the right person for this, for that conversation overall in terms of prison reform, sentence reforms, things like that. But what we did say, I think we both said it, was, hey, if something positive comes of it, no matter who the messenger is,
right,
then it's a good thing, right? No idea what the impact would be. The impact was she got this woman released, right? Yeah. Now, you can sit there and question Trump's motives. He's only trying to do it for publicity, to earn favor with black people, this, that, and the other thing. But he did it. And she is a big reason why that happened. So a woman gets her the rest of her life to make things
outside,
right,
yeah,
and kind of rebuild. It was Kim Kardashian, but she did it. So
yeah. Thumbs up Trump from me.
Thumbs up both of them. For her to feel passionate enough about it to use whatever leverage you have, that's the benefit of, like, I mean, we want to criticize her. She's famous for no reason. She's rich for no reason. Okay, well, she is, and there's nothing that you can do about it. And if she's going to use her powers for good, then so be it. I think I said last week, I had a big crush on her, and then saw her and that went away, and but if she can, in spite of Kanye and his madness, which all of a sudden I have a different thought on Kanye now.
I kind of do too, actually.
But for different reasons, I'm realizing something. Then God bless her, I guess is all I could say.
Good job out of her. Good job out of Trump.
Good job out of you.
Although I'm a little concerned that Trump is not getting the pardon thing isn't like Twitter 2.0 or Twitter 2.0, because now he's saying to NFL players, instead of kneeling during the anthem, which he will cannot stop bringing up and not stop needling on, he's now saying, instead of doing that, recommend people for me to pardon. I don't know how those things are connected. I don't think that really respects the power of the pardon by the presidency. And to be fair, every president, I mean, when a president is leaving office, it's a historical thing that they will pardon people. I forget what they call it. Is it exit pardons or whatever? Right. There's a term for it where he's like, I'm going to do all the shit I want to do. I'm leaving office and you can't do anything about it. So, hey, Bill Clinton pardoned his brother-in-law and
Obama pardoned a number of people that had been arrested on drug charges,
right.
And things like that, and some of them I don't want to because there's a some of the people had additional charges that were like, oh, he had a gun, so why blah blah.
Right, whatever. Yeah.
But I mean Obama did a lot of that, and every president most presidents have done it. I think there were a couple who maybe didn't. I saw a list a while ago. As Obama was going out, someone put out a list of every president and who they pardoned and how many people they pardoned or whatever. So I think this is the part of Trump not being a politician, not being someone who understands the process of government. This is where he's just like, all right, this is where I can make my mark and do something good, right? And he kind of looks at it like when he was just a billionaire playboy and, oh, yeah, we'll throw a benefit for whatever. Like, it's cool. It's a tax write-off. And I could, we'll throw a bit. What for the
sure.
The NAACR or the NAACC or whatever, the National Colored People of Advanced Ninja Skills. Yeah, sure, whatever. Yeah, we'll do a benefit for them and it'll be a tax write-off. It'll be great. You know,
I'll chase some tail during this whole thing. And hopefully get laid.
Yeah, I'll get laid, and maybe I'll knock up a black chick. Who knows? Or breast cancer. Yeah, I love tits. Yeah, let's do that. So, and I think he's looking at it like, oh, pardon? Yeah, oh man, people will love me if I pardon.
I can just do this,
right? Pardon everybody. Give me a rapo. Give me this guy. Give me. So I think that the way Trump looks at it. He looks at it through his eyes of somewhat naivety in terms of how the process works, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing. And even if he's doing it for PR, even if he's doing it for reasons that we don't feel are the right reasons, and that necessarily doesn't matter, right? I mean, because if the end result is the right result, then I'm not sure there's a good reason to attack it, right? Because there are people I know, I have a list of people who, no matter who Trump pardons, they're going to attach a asterisk or a disclaimer saying, yeah, he's only doing this to win favor, curry with X group of people. And for me, I'm going to say, you know who doesn't really give a fuck? The person he pardoned and that person's family and friends and the other people that he may have given hope to.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so I think that I can deal with this. If he's going to go through and he's going to allow the NFL players to come to the table and have a conversation, and because I believe there are plenty of enlightened enough players who can in a short amount of time gather a list and say, here's a list of people who have been unjustly imprisoned for way too long. Here you go. Put your money where your mouth is. And I think Donald Trump will look at that and say, well, I can't get upstaged by, these football players who I've been attacking for this amount of time. And I think this is also, whether we like it or not, this is somewhat of an olive branch to the NFL and the players, right?
Yeah.
You recognize, because I think the reality is, no matter, like, this, it draws a lot, like, this whole thing with the anthem and Trump and the players, like, it gets a lot of media coverage. And so based off of conservative media, Fox News, Breitbart, the president himself, and the followers of all that, you would think that there's nobody going to NFL games, the NFL lost money last year, and they're going to lose money, and the NFL is going to fold. Well, the NFL made $14 billion. They were up 2% over their year over the previous year. They're on pace to make $20 billion by 2027. And the NFL, the biggest thing, and people are looking at the ratings and say, oh, the ratings are dropping. Well, the ratings are dropping because streaming doesn't count in the ratings, right? And there's a lot more people streaming a lot of NFL games now. So that doesn't count in the ratings. So that attributes to a large percentage of the drop in the ratings of the NFL. And once they figure out how to calculate that in, I guarantee you that the ratings for the NFL are just fine. So what I'm saying is the NFL is doing just fine. The MAGA crowd who boycotted, you barely made a dent. For all the people who support Kaepernick and all the people who say, oh, you're holding black men down and I'm not going to support a league that holds black men down, you didn't make a dent. Sorry, there's too many people like me and you, Jim, and other people out there who love the NFL, who can separate politics from entertainment and say, I can watch it and I could still not like X, Y, or Z, but still enjoy my team. I can still enjoy fantasy. I can still enjoy betting. And oh, by the way,
you'll be able to bet. Oh, by the way,
we can pretty soon a lot more people are going to be able to bet in their home state. And if you don't think that's going to have a positive impact,
I mean, people do it all the time. NFL,
right.
But they used to do it illegally.
Right.
And I
mean, but now for people to be able to openly bet on the NFL, child, please.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, come on now. I mean, like, listen, you can tell me to boycott and blah, 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 but you're not going to change my mind. And there's a lot. Like, I played ball with too many guys like me and too many people. I know too many people just being here from the Midwest. I mean, I know people who really wanted to be super MAGA, make America great again, and not watch football. But they are diehard Steeler fans. And when the Steelers were on their way to the playoffs, all that shit went through the window, and they got back on the bandwagon. They turned their TVs on. They bought the new sideline hat, and it was go Antonio Brown, go Ben Roethlisberger, go Le'Veon Bell.
I'm going to protest. I'm not going to get up at 10 in the morning and watch the London game. I'll show you.
Right.
But the Steelers are out at one, right. And I'll be there
for that. So I'm not going to watch it, but I will stream it.
Which is back to your point. I do think there were other marketing mistakes. I do think they oversaturated with a 10 a.m. game, a 1 p.m. game.
And agreed. Like there is, I think there's multiple logical reasons on why it's dipped. And maybe there are people who are turned off literally by the game itself. It's too violent, concussions, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I'll buy that. And I agree. And I think the oversaturation is a problem. But the whole idea that Breitbart was able to reduce the money that the NFL makes is fucking ludicrous.
It is. But it makes good
talk. It's good for them. It's good for them because it fires up their listeners. You know, and Donald Trump can do
this. By the way,
this.
There was another death this week. Dwight Clark died.
God,
Dwight
yeah.
Clark, who I remember. So Dwight Clark is famous. He was a receiver for the 49ers. He basically broke the, was that?
He was a tight end.
No, he wasn't. Dwight Clark was a receiver. I'll go to the mat on this one. All right, I'm going to keep talking. You look it up. He's most famous because he made what is nicknamed the catch. He caught a ball thrown by Joe Montana. And I want to say,
he was a receiver.
Yeah, he was. In your defense, I was, I think, 12 when that happened, or 14. So
wait, pump your fucking brakes. Dwight Clark was an American football wide receiver slash tight end.
Slash tight end. He wasn't that big a guy.
In 1987.
Okay, all right. He was listed as a wide receiver every time I saw it.
You know why I remember him as a tight end?
I don't.
Because of Joe Montana football on Sega.
Okay.
Bill Walsh football on Sega, and I think I don't know if he was on Super Tecmo Bowl or not.
Well, anyway,
but he was listed as a tight end.
All right, and I always remember being listed as a player, as a receiver.
Well, but think about the reason why I think I'm almost positive he was
a slot receiver before there really was a slot receiver.
He was a Y receiver, and it's Bill Walsh. And I'm gonna football nerd out a little bit, but in the West Coast offense, Jerry Rice was the X. John Taylor was the Z. Or no, I'm sorry.
But I think
Clark was the Y.
The end of Clark's career and Jerry Rice would have barely. I don't know if Taylor and Clark overlapped. They're real close. The catch happens at the end of Clark's career. He only played for like 6 or 7 years. But anyway,
who was the other receiver?
Golly. The name Freddie Solomon is going in my head, and that's wrong, but that's the name that's in my head. Anyway, Dwight Clark also passed away, and he made one of the most famous plays in history. He reached back, caught a Joe Montana pass after a scramble to beat the Dallas Cowboys in a time where the Cowboys were considered to be, you know, America's team and the luckiest team in America and whatever. Sorry for derailing things.
Fine. I mean, but, I mean, Dwight Clark has a connection here in Cleveland because he was the general manager here.
Oh, I totally did not. I almost forgot that. I didn't know that.
Yeah, Dwight Clark was the general manager here in Cleveland when the Browns came back.
I totally don't remember that. Wow.
Yeah, he was. And he, you know, he gets a bad rep because the team was bad and has been bad for the last 20 years since they came back. But when the team came back, Dwight Clark was a general manager, and he was handpicked by, you know, that group,
the ownership group, sure.
And
so Tim Couch became a Brown because of Dwight Clark.
Yeah, right. And you know, right? Is that the timeline? Was it? Was he?
99 was the first year that they came back. So we're gonna be up against time, and I do want to talk one more Trump thing.
Yeah, he was the director. He was the general manager and director of football operations for the Browns from 99 to 2002. He quit when the Browns hired Butch Davis.
Okay. I want to jump back to Trump, though, because there's another big deal, and it's something I talked about a while ago, and that is Trump apparently has said he is going to support Cory Booker's and the federal legal ban on marijuana. I'm actually looking into something. Ohio medical marijuana is a thing that I'm hoping to go to a conference in Cleveland for next week, although I'll be back on the road. I don't know if I can swing it. Regardless of that, I have obviously talked about on the show. I'm a non-pot smoking big believer in legalization. Getting rid of the federal ban would change the game so much. When Cory Booker and Chuck Schumer put their things out there, you were pretty skeptical, especially of Chuck Schumer, but above both of them.
I wasn't skeptical of Chuck Schumer. My issue was the way in which he did it.
Okay.
He did it on 420. You said, oh, that was a coincidence. I'm like, no, fuck
you. I don't think I said Chuck Schumer. It was coincidence. I said he might not have known the significance.
Whatever. Anyway, but to your broader point, this is a relatively big deal. Now we'll see what sort of action follow Trump's words. You know, he said it at a press gaggle before he got on the plane to go to the G7 summit or on like once he had landed. But the fact that he's saying, like, listen, I'll support this. This is the thing we talked about almost 2 years ago when we said at some point Trump is going to have to move closer towards the center. And I think we're at that point now where there's so much rhetoric, there's so much division that he's not going to do it through apologies. He's not going to do it through air quotes concessions, but he will start to commit to things and just kind of let it be, you know, so it was said, so it was done, sort of. And so he puts it out there, he floats it out there that he'll support Cory Booker's legislation. It's interesting that he's saying Booker's and not Schumer's.
That's not surprising.
It's not, but I mean, the question is, which is better?
Yeah,
which is better for, you know, the cannabis industry and the overall well-being of everyone overall. And so his kind of early signal that he will support this is promising. And I didn't have the time to take a look to kind of see where, you know, any cannabis companies that are publicly traded, where their stock was today. Because I
own a few cannabis stocks. I didn't pay attention to where they're at today.
It'd be interesting to see where they, you know, kind of where they were and where they ended today off of that news.
How much of this could be Trump throwing another fuck you at Jeff Sessions? Because a while ago, I don't remember if I said it on the show or on a video rant that was separate from the show, where I said, hey, Trump, here's your chance. You get to tell Jeff Sessions fuck you and earn support and get young people to like you a lot more. You know, this is your move.
Well, I think it's all of that. I think it's him moving towards it's him moving towards the center on things that he feels that he can and not lose favor. I think the fuck you to Jeff Sessions. Sessions has clearly fallen out of favor with Trump. You know, which we've known for over a year now. So it's a signal to Jeff, like, you know, I think it's one more thing to try to push him out the door. Absolutely, but there's a lot of political value in doing this. You know, first of all, there's a lot of political value in saying this. There's even more if there's follow through and execution. The follow through and execution on that for him, maybe, probably gets him reelected.
Well, what I think it does a huge thing for is helps the in states where marijuana is recreationally legal, where Senate, Republican congressmen and senators have been really punched in the dick by Jeff Sessions, it gives them a, hey, this is our guy vibe going into the midterms. And right now the midterms are everything for this president.
Right. The reality is, once you take away that ban,
the floodgates are open, right?
Right, and I mean,
and good. And, it's and, so and a stupid good that it's legal right. in California, I mean, because, but it's illegal if a federal person tries to. That's crazy,
right?
And if you're a states' rights person, you should be all for this,
right? And what it does is it also allows states to go back and say, all right, if you're in jail for an extended period of time for weed, then let's get you out of jail, let's wipe your record, and let's get you reintroduced in society.
Yep.
So there's a lot of positive political, clout to be gained by doing this, you know, and some of it is just playing politics, but some of it is listen, if it's all playing politics, but he follows through and executes, then I don't care.
Right.
You know, I don't care.
If you do the right thing for the wrong reason, I'll take that over doing the wrong thing for the right reason.
Right.
I think so. I don't know. I just made that up.
But I mean, either way, if you're doing the right thing, I'll take it.
I agree.
You know, I mean, especially the positive impact that this can have. So
getting nonviolent people out of jail is what I'm all for. I mean,
right. I mean, let's get nonviolent people out of jail. Let's stop giving police just a reason to attack a certain group of people. You know, obviously the police are arresting and using weed and marijuana as a predisposition, as a way to search and arrest young black men. It's just, it is what it is. You know, I mean, you look in these cities, you know, Denver, in the state of Colorado, you know, young black men are still being arrested at higher rates than anybody else for weed, for marijuana possession.
How are they getting arrested in Colorado?
Because there's still...
Oh, there's the legalization, there's right, aspects, I mean, of it. Okay.
There's still certain aspects of what you can and can't do on the streets. And... you know, if you want to give me, well, they shouldn't be doing that, I don't disagree. But the problem is that there's white kids doing it too, and they're not getting arrested.
And the solution right? is not arrest more not, white kids.
Right. It's leave just the like black stop, kids alone. Just leave everybody alone. Right. I mean, like,
you said this in the last show that, like, if, you know, the solution isn't do it back to the other groups. The issue is it's fucking wrong. Let's stop doing
it. Like, leave this group of people alone.
All right, man. We should wrap up now because we're up against time. Let's skip Come At Me Bro this week and let's challenge the audience. No one has chimed into me with a Come At Me Bro for you.
Or
okay.
So actually, I do have a Come At Me
Bro. Okay.
I have to.
I don't have a good one. So, all
right. No, it's fine. No, if you don't have one, it's fine. I have one.
Come at me.
My Come At Me Bro for you is the workout that I sent you for your biceps.
Oh, boy.
Scared the shit out of you, and that's the reason why you didn't do it.
I did do it.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Oh,
so I went for 50. So the challenge was do 10 hammer curls with. I did the highest weight at the hotel gym.
So
which was 50 pound dumbbell. Go ahead.
So I'll lay it out. So this is what it is. I said he reached out to me and said, hey, want to do something for the biceps? What do I do? I said, all right. I know you're in a hotel, so you know, do 3 sets with the heaviest weight you can do for sets of 10. You know, 3 sets of 10, and then on the 4th set. You do that same weight for 10 reps, and then you run the rack, meaning if it's 50, you do 50 for 10, and then you do 45 for 10, 40 for 10.
Didn't quite do it.
And then all the way down. Or if you skip where you go.
I went 50, 40, 30, 20, 10.
Fine. That's fine.
And I got through 10 sets, or 10 reps of each set. And I could barely lift my arms when it was done. I looked like an idiot with 10-pound dumbbells in my hand. And literally, that was the same night I do a trivia contest with my coworkers. And I literally was like resting my arms. I used a post-recovery supplement that's part of my diet thing.
Yeah.
And I was not in agony the next. I'm still. I don't know if you've seen. I've been rubbing my forearms. Yeah. It's. I'm still got a little bit of lactic acid soreness in my forearms and biceps, but it was not as agonizing as I was sure it was going to be an hour after the workout because my arms were jello.
Yeah, so that's what I like because I'm not a big curl guy. I do a lot of big, multi
compound movements. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, curls are kind of like the last thing on my mind, but I like my arms to have symmetry. And because of the, you know, the deadlifting and everything else that I do, I don't want to tear a bicep. So I do curls for the functional purpose and for the aesthetic look. And that's usually my go-to because I have a short amount of time. So I'll bang out three sets at a at whatever weight that I'm using, and then I'll just go ahead and run the rack. Now, at my gym, I have, you know...
Humble brag coming.
Well, no, at my gym, it you know, the dumbbells go all the way up to 250 pounds.
You're not curling 250-pound dumbbells.
I'm not, but what I'm saying is that I can literally go from whatever weight all the way down to fives, and there have been times where I get to the fives and I just like I can barely
that has to be comical.
Fonda
would be using today,
right? I mean, people know. I mean, you do. I mean, it's just it's a thing, but it gets the job done. It pumps a lot of blood in there, and then the biceps look good, and then you get out angle people when you take the pictures. You know what I'm saying?
All right, and there we go. No, I did do it, and I was actually going to type fuck you in a text.
But you couldn't?
I couldn't, yeah. I was too sore. I was literally just going to text fuck you and then go to trivia, and I'm like, no, he's trying to help. It was a good workout, and in the hotel it is tough. But yes, I was cursing you as I was doing it.
Well, good.
And then I met the intended purpose. All right, man.
I helped you and brought you pain.
And you, a win-win, as you would call it. Yes. Thank you very much. All right, this has been Whiskey Congress. We're at Whiskey Congress on all social media. Steve at Whiskey Congress, Jim at Whiskey Congress for emails. Please send us if you want me to ask Steve a question or vice versa. Text or email us or reach out to us, and we'll
don't
text us unless you know us, because that's weird. All right, man. Good talking to you. Let's wrap this up.
All right, wrap her up.